All right, let's go for it. Let's start with the questions. One was Jean, one was... Jean, why don't you start with yours?
Well, I don't know a lot about the millennial, 1,000 years. Will that be on this earth when Jesus comes to this earth, not the new earth?
Yes, correct. Anyone who believes, as I do, in a literal 1,000-year millennial kingdom, that's Revelation 20, and it's prior to the new earth. Christ returns to the old earth, sets up a kingdom for 1,000 years. That's completed. Final judgment. Then, Revelation 21, new heavens, new earth.
Okay. Will there be sin, birth, marriage during that time? What?
Yes. Most people who believe in that literal 1,000-year kingdom believe that those who are alive when Christ returns, all prior to that will be resurrected, but those who are alive when Christ returns, those who've come to faith, and now it gets complicated because those who believe in a pre-tribulational rapture believe a certain thing, and those who believe in historic premillennialism as I do, which is a different thing. But anyway, usually it's believed that there will be some people who will be in their original earthly bodies. They will have come to faith in Christ, but will not be resurrected, to not get into the complications of it. I'll just say that much. And then those people will actually, continue to have families, children will be born. And then that explains why in Revelation 20, it talks about a rebellion that happens in the millennial kingdom. That there's actually people let me just read it directly. The 1,000 years, it says, when the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison. Well, let's go back. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. So he is let out of the pit where he's been for 1,000 years, and then he deceives people still on the old earth. But this is after Christ has returned. And then that rebellion is squelched, and the devil who deceived them was thrown in the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Now those, by the way, my friends, includes most in the Reformed tradition, who are amillennial, argue, okay, you're saying Christ returns to the earth magnificently to set up his kingdom, but then that doesn't work. People rebel against it, and then there's like a second battle of Armageddon that essentially goes on at the end of the millennial kingdom. See, the battle of Armageddon being the, like when the first coming of Christ... we're actually the second coming of Christ, when he comes to the earth. And then you're saying, so this is, it just seems like, wow, that's anticlimactic to have Christ return and bring his kingdom of righteousness only to have people rebel against him. Satan once again does his work and once again is conquered. So they take the millennium as a figurative expression. The problem is, with that position, it has many attractive things about it, but it's pretty hard to deal with the text, because they say, well, the millennial kingdom that's talked about, this time of great increased righteousness on the earth, is that which God's saints in heaven are reigning with Christ right now over the earth. To which the problem is, wow, not sure they're doing a great job of it. But their argument, though, is there is actually less evil in the world, much less evil in the world, as a result of the inroads of the Christian faith. And certainly that can be argued pretty effectively. Much less evil, though, is one thing. You know, would it be a period in any meaningful sense of a reign of Christ and some level of peace on the earth after the, you know, what happened in the 20th century? That's a difficult case to make, but some of my friends make it. Each position has problems.
Will we recognize Christ during that time?
During the millennial kingdom? Yes. I mean, this is where if Christ is indeed sitting on a throne for 1,000 years and has returned to the earth, then yes, he is recognized as ruling over all. And probably then those who end up rebelling against him have passively acquiesced to his dominion, but in their hearts. See, these are people being born. It's not an issue of loss of salvation. These are new people coming into the world, being born, and they can either embrace Christ or reject Christ, but it would be quiet rejection at first and then ultimately open rebellion led by Satan.
Okay, so can people make decisions to follow Christ during that time?
Yes.
If they have, you know, like rejected him or just been indifferent before?
Well, yes, they could, but keeping in mind that these would only be people who have been born since the return of Christ. Because when Christ returns, if you're alive and you've rejected him, then you're swept away in a what could be called a preliminary judgment. Now, again, those who take the position of no literal millennium go immediately from the return of Christ to a universal judgment. Which is nice to not then have the problem of waiting and explaining other people in rebellion and all. So, you know, a book that is good in that regard, the InterVarsity Press and Zondervan, two publishers, both have a series of books that are sometimes called the 3 views books, 4 views books, 5 views books. They vary. 4 is probably about the average. Views.
Okay.
So 4 views of election and predestination, 4 views of sovereignty, free will, 4 views of, and then there's a couple that are eschatology related, and so there would probably be 4 views of the millennium, or 5 views of the millennium. Yes?
I don't see too much of a big problem to imagine some people rejecting Christ after coming back the second time, because I think, in my opinion, it happened before with the people of Israel. You know, they've seen all the miracles and everything in Egypt. They experienced God like on a daily base in the wilderness, and still they like, because seeing by faith has nothing to do with what we see. It's a state of our heart, basically,
right?
And a choice that if you want to do, you do for God, or if you can do against Him. So
yeah.
I think it's very, very easy to, for some people, and because Satan is locked up in those like 1,000 years, he has no influence on them, but their hearts are mean.
Right.
So when Satan is again set free, the rebellion just...
Sure, he appeals to the sin that is already present in the heart. And some argue, some premillennialists argue that what the millennium proves is the need for the radically translated no more sin nature, no more curse, no more Satan in the world. You know, that it's the proof that you can't just take this earth and make it better, even with Christ present on a throne. And when you, and then it will be like, okay, this is a 1,000-year period, but that's a short length of time compared to human history, but in particular compared to eternity, and it will forever cement in people's minds the need to be grateful for the no more sin in God's eternal kingdom, which, by the way, takes us to something, and then we'll hit.
I was just going to ask that question, address the question of whether there could be a rebellion on the
Right. This is something you hear quite frequently. I've got a chapter devoted to this in my Big Heaven book. It's a good-sized book, so there's chapters devoted to the number of these issues. But some people say, well, look, you had a perfect world, and you had human beings, Adam and Eve, and they ended up sinning. So what are you talking about? You're going to have a new perfect world. So what's going to keep people from sinning in that world? And I think there's a definitive biblical answer to that, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. No. I'm kidding. But I was trying to think of the passage in Matthew. Is it 24? Where the angels go out, and it says they. I have too many marks, I mean, too many little notes here, where it says that the angels are sent the four corners of the earth, and then they will remove all causes of sin. I'm not finding it right now. But in any case, there's some pretty definite saying that all causes of sin will be removed from the world. Now, it's not just Satan who causes sin. There has to be something in people to appeal to at least tempt them. Now, it doesn't have to be a sin nature, because Adam and Eve didn't have a sin nature. But here's the definitive answer, I think. That is, that we will not simply have innocence. We have the very righteousness of Christ. We are the very righteousness of Christ.
Those are the only inhabitants of the new earth.
Right. The only people who will be on the new earth are people who have been transformed by the regenerating work of Christ and have been removed from sin and curse. And he has made him to be sin for us, he who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. So that, having the very righteousness of Christ, we would be no more prone to sin than Christ would be prone to sin. Plus, there's the argument of utter clarity and enlightenment. Sin operates on the basis of deception. It will pay off. Well, when you know, definitively, it will not pay off. And you have experienced that yourself, which Adam and Eve had not, and therefore were prone to deceive. Sin? Are you kidding me? Been there, done that. Didn't work out very well. It'll be no appeal to sin. No basis for appeal. Does that make sense?
Yes. Just a comment on that. I've heard somewhere, I can't remember who said it, but when Adam and Eve were in Eden, that they had the ability to sin and not to sin. They had the choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the fall, we were now sinful from birth, and we no longer had the choice not to sin. And by being covered by Christ's blood, we again have the choice to sin and not to sin. And then on the new heaven and new earth, we will no longer have the choice to sin. I mean, we will be completely pure.
Yes, well, very well said. And I also think, though, that the way that connects, then, some people then say, oh, so you're saying we'll have no free choice. And no, we will have a freedom of choice, even now, okay, we have a freedom of choice to choose consistent with the nature that we have. We don't have a freedom to not be sinners. We are sinners. See, so we can choose, yes. Yeah, sinners can make all kinds of choices. But the choice to be utterly, totally non-sinful is not open to us, because by nature, we are sinners. Okay, now, when we are by nature utterly and absolutely righteous, now you can say, well, but aren't we that now? Well, there's great complications, because, you know, the saved from you know, the power of sin, and you're sanctified, or what is it? Ultimately, it'll be saved from the presence of sin. Now, the penalty of sin. Yeah, originally saved from the penalty of sin. We were saved from the penalty of sin. We are being saved from the power of sin. We will be saved from the presence of sin. So it's the problem of already and not yet. Yes, we have a new nature, but we also do battle with, depending on your theology, how you see it, the old nature or the habits and ingrained sin patterns of the old person that are still with us. But when that day comes, we will have a freedom to choose consistent with having the very righteousness of Christ. So you can choose anything. Actually, in the last battle, what is that little exchange where I think we have entered the world where you can't make bad choices is the idea. I forget the wording on it. But where everything, you can, like, should we eat this? Well, it's all permitted. Yes. And that isn't because God lowers his standards. It's because when you are by nature righteous, you don't make evil choices. It's just simply, it's not in you to do that. A choice must be consistent with what is in you. And it might sound strange because you say, yeah, but there was no sin in Adam and Eve. No, but there was, even in their innocence, an ability to choose sin and a basic naivete, ignorance of the implications of it all. Yeah. You first, and then you give the rebuttal to him. Yes.
You alluded to this towards the end of your talk this morning, where the whole adage of why polish brass on a sinking ship, you mentioned the Titanic. I think that's just pervasive in the evangelical thought.
Yes.
And so how does, our divorce from culture is evidence of that, how does being heavenly minded make us more missional and purposeful on earth?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think 2 Peter 3 gives at least a picture of that. Where it says, and very interesting, remember that 2 Peter 3 is talking about in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing, following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. You know, it's like an argument from naturalism and that there's no intervention, no miracles are being done. And then it says, but they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed. The earth was formed out of water. By these waters, also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. That was a miracle of judgment, the flood. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment. Notice the terminology. The present heavens and earth, that is, heavens and earth the way they are now in a fallen cosmos. Don't mistake the word heavens for heaven, just the dwelling place of God. Heavens, the stars, the planets, the universe. A synonym for heavens and earth is universe. So Genesis 1:1 talks about the creation of the universe we're in now. That universe then fell. And all, according to, you know, Romans 8, all Romans 5, really, and that whole line of argument, that the entire creation fell under us, human beings, Adam and Eve. It all fell on our coattails, and it will all rise on our coattails in the resurrection. So then he says, with the Lord, a day is as 1,000 years. Do not forget one thing. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is his day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. He's patient with you, not just patient with unbelievers, patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar, the elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be laid bare, is the NIV's translation, and it's a very good one. Not, yes, it will be destroyed, but it will be shown to be what it is, laid bare, since everything will be destroyed in this way. Now, getting to your question, since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be presently, right now? You ought to be holy, to live holy and godly lives. Now listen to this. As you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That is, that you do things that actually will lend themselves to the return of Christ. That you share your faith, that you live out a life that you know cares for people and wins people, that you reach people of every tribe and nation and language, etc., and speed its coming. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat, but in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth. Yeah, we recognize it's going to be destroyed. We are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness. So then, dear friends, since you are looking forward to this, make every effort to be found spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. Application to our lives is knowing that we will forever live in a world of righteousness. Let us do all that we can to bring to bear the righteousness of Christ, the joy of Christ, the mercy of Christ in this world as it now is. Never believing that it doesn't matter because the world's going to be destroyed. Yeah, but it's going to be resurrected. That's like saying it doesn't matter whether I take care of my body because I'm going to die anyway. Okay, it doesn't matter. Yeah, but God has given you that body and you're going to live in a body for eternity. You're going to live in that body for eternity. Now, does it mean that you're going to have all the diseases and all of the scars and all of the... No, no, no. But it does matter. And so, since you are looking forward to this, make every effort to be found spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. And it's as if Peter is saying, if you weren't looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, maybe if you just got the first part of it, which is that this one's going to be destroyed, but you didn't get the second part, that you're going to have, and we're going to live in a new heavens, new earth forever, maybe you wouldn't be motivated to make every effort to be obedient, spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. Bear in mind that our Lord's patience means salvation. And then it goes on from there. So I think... Though it's focused on purity and living the pure life, which makes sense because if you're going to live on a new earth that is the home of righteousness forever, for eternity, then don't you want to get a head start on that now? Don't you want to live that kind of righteous life now, even on this old world? And, of course, much of the righteousness that involves is going to involve helping other people. The culture aspects.
And ecological
aspects. Like, now some people, let me tell you this story. I was speaking at a conference of Christian young people, most in their 20s. And there were 3,000 of them at this conference. And it's a conference that's put on by a Bible teaching church, but many, many other churches and kids, young people come from all over the country to this. And I was speaking on New Heavens and New Earth, and I was starting with Genesis 1 and 2. And I just made a passing comment about how, okay, since God created this world... Well, and let me say this. You have to understand that this is a very responsive group where when the speaker says something they like, they'll applaud. Okay? very vigorously. And I got number of times applauded, and other speakers were, you know, they'd clap when we'd say something that really resonated. And I said something about, since God created this world that we live in, doesn't it make sense that we would be good stewards of it, that we would want to take care of it, and that we would just, you know, and I said something about...
We as believers should be leading the path.
Leading the way.
Leading this dominion over this earth.
I'm right.
Talking about that.
Yes.
And what does it mean to have dominion? And
right.
A large part of that is right. Taking care.
Yes. Okay. So I say this, and hopefully better than I just said it now, and there's applause from one person. Now, there's 3,000 people sitting in this auditorium. There's other speakers, there's this, you know, and all. Okay, now, what struck me was, first, I really felt sorry for whoever that poor person was who applauded, but I also had a sense of, and I actually commented, and I said, oh, that's interesting. One person applauds for taking care of the world God created. And I kind of sort of made the point there and moved on. Well, I know and love these people and the tradition they come from. But see, in that tradition, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. And so share your faith, reach them with the gospel. But right, why rearrange the furniture on the Titanic, you know, or polish the brass, as you said. Okay, so so afterwards, Nancy and I were walking out, and there were other things in the message that they applauded and responded to, and it was no big deal. But as we were walking away, I said, boy, didn't you feel sorry for that person who applauded? Nancy says, that was me. There you go. Okay, but that would be an example of what I think are you talking
See,
about.
That's a depressing story.
Yeah. Oh, of course. It's a depressing story.
I get criticized for being green and a Christian.
That's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. But here's the interesting aspect, is that of all people, this group of people should have known better because they should have been taught better, but they haven't been. And what's fascinating is then to go over to another group of people who really get that we should take care of this earth. They just don't believe the Bible. Yeah. And it's like, can we both believe the Bible and think we should take care of the earth precisely because we do believe the Bible? Sure. And this is where it's just weird that it's like sometimes you have to choose up sides. Like, the same thing in the political realm where, okay, so could we, if we're so concerned about this disadvantaged person and this poor person, and I am, and let's help them, could we also be concerned about unborn children? I would think we could. Why can't we be? And then we're with this group over here, and not to point. There, I mean, I didn't mean to. No, but we're with another group over here, and it's like, well, we care about unborn children, but we don't care about the environment, and we don't care, which, by the way, caring about the environment is not just because the environment's the environment. That means caring about people, because the environment greatly affects people. Okay, so why do we have to go over here for this set of beliefs, and then go over here for that set of beliefs? Well, obviously, because political parties, politics isn't the answer, ultimately. But nonetheless, I think we as Christians have to say, my calling is not to be conservative, and my calling is not to be liberal. My calling is to be Christian, to believe the Word, to follow Jesus, which sometimes means I will appear to be conservative. And other times, I will appear to be liberal. But my goal in life is neither to be conservative nor liberal. It's to follow Jesus. And you may think 80% of the time following Jesus, though, is going to make you look conservative or make you look liberal. I mean, we can have differences of opinions on that. But it really concerns me. And I have friends who are very conservative and friends who are very liberal, who are Christians,
And I have exactly the same argument with each. Don't reduce it to conserve and liberate. So conserve that which is honoring to Christ in a culture and advocate being liberated from that which is dishonoring to Christ, conservative liberal. But anyway, that relates back. Yes, who is the next question? Was it, yeah?
Well, I just wanted to add to the idea that in terms of what does it say to the evangelical or missional aspects of our life, there are other biblical passages that allude to an end of a time when we can do certain things and we are called to the field because the grain is ripe.
Yes.
You know, we are called to the Great Commission to spread the word. In addition to being told about the afterlife, those other parts of the Bible give us a purpose in this life.
Right. Yeah.
But, well, I guess what I'm getting at is that that's agreed. I think that's what evangelicals got in the last 100 years. I mean, they got that message, just really spread the gospel everywhere.
Right.
But we're not in the arts. We're not building buildings that last. We're not making things that last beyond us because of the good sense of urgency, but not the what about my children, my grandchildren. That's what I meant by like, your comment that you said this morning. I don't know if there's not enough teaching on the image of God and living it out and honoring Him, but I was trying to see, is there a correlation? Because there's that quote by Lewis that you said last week of that you find that people who thought most of heaven made most of their lives. That's a
right, yeah, the Wilberforce and all those, yeah.
Right.
Well, see, I think if you think that culture is going to end, literally, human culture will end when this planet goes up in smoke. If you believe there's no culture in the world to come, wouldn't that kind of make you a little either less excited about culture and art, including everything? I mean, but culture is so broad. But I mean, arts and science and literature and all that. It certainly would make you think, well, if I love arts and science and culture, this is my one shot at it. This is it. You know, so you could either say it's unimportant because it won't be in the world to come, or you could think that I better make it everything and grab onto it now and define my life by these things and cling to it and be less interested in the world to come. Because the world to come is not going to have culture. Well, that's just wrong. I mean, you know, reading those verses at the end of Revelation 21, and let me go back and then get into chapter 22, which expands it further. I mean, listen, the nations will walk by its light. The kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it, into the new Jerusalem. On no day will its gates ever be shut. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. There are still nations on the earth. There are redeemed nations. And it said, the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. The kings of the nations of the earth. They're bringing their splendor. This word is translated sometimes treasures. And it's a word that the best in studying that word, I'm convinced that it means the cultural treasures, the splendors, the arts, the crafts, the, you know, think of, I often use this illustration, but the movie The Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille, and where they bring in the people of Ethiopia, and he says, I give you Ethiopia. Is it Charlton Heston who says that, otherwise known as Moses, or, you know, whatever. And so they come in, and here are the people of Ethiopia, and here are these beautiful crafted things, and here's their music, and their arts, and all of this. And these spices, and these are basically laid at the feet of Pharaoh. Tribute. I think that's exactly what it's talking about. The kings of the nations of the earth will bring their splendors, their treasures, into the New Jerusalem. Well, why are they bringing it in? Well, who's sitting on the throne in the New Jerusalem? Christ is. So they bring it in as tribute to Him. And whether there will be just a free exchange of the wealth of the nations and the cultural treasure of the nations? I think so. And probably auditoriums where music and arts and, you know, all of these things. By the way, think of the nature of it being a city. You know, there's a lot of people who say, well, I don't want it to be a city. I don't like cities. Well, one of the things that cities, yeah, well, that's, and what I tell people is, well, yeah, you don't like the downside of cities. You don't like pollution. You don't like crime. You don't like excessive noise. You don't like, that's what you don't like. But people coming together, the arts, sports, arenas, events, those aren't out in the country. They're in centers of population. Okay, centers of population. I think the new earth will have the country, the remote areas. You know, people are coming in the gates of the city from the nations outside. That means that there are good. Now, some people misunderstand because they say, well, wait, outside are the dogs and the, in a figure of speech, not, you know, the corpse, the mangy corpse-eating beasts, okay? So we don't want this to be the domestic dog thing. But you know, the figure of speech is being used of the unredeemed. They're outside the gate. Well, that means they can't, they won't even be living on the new earth, okay? But these kings of the nations are redeemed. They're coming in and bringing gifts and tribute and praise. And so I think it's very likely when we're told that there are people of every tribe and nation and language, every tribe and nation and language. Well, take Egypt. Take Egypt of various time periods. Okay, does that mean of today's Egypt? Or does that mean of ancient Egypt, where some surely were believers? I mean, think of Joseph and his influence in those days. And some of what we would even call pagan cultures influenced in some way, you know, by a true faith, whether it's by people representing it to them or angels appearing to them or, you know, whatever it is. On the new earth, might there be not only Egypt, but this Egypt and that Egypt and another Egypt, and why not? Do we all, does somebody who died 2,000 years ago have to immediately plug in to the latest technology and way of doing things on the new earth? Perhaps they can, but would they have to? I don't think so. Wouldn't it be wonderful to not simply go to another nation of all redeemed people, but go to another nation of another time of redeemed people, all now currently living together on the new earth? You know, that's speculative. But what's not speculative is that there will be nations, and they will have kings, and they will bring their treasures into the New Jerusalem. That part is not speculative. It says it.
I have a two-part question. So then, when you were talking about bringing in things from other tribes and nations,
yes,
into the city, it's kind of like Augustine's, taking
city of God.
Yeah, taking the good from pagan cultures.
Yeah,
and using it to, I guess, expound on Christianity.
Yes,
kind of like taking that but making it better. But
yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm a visual person, so I'm interested.
Yeah.
So when you're saying that it's like a city, and so people are coming together and they bring all their goods, so then in the Great Divorce, when they talk about how I forget what they call it, the Gray Land, I believe it's called, and everyone's moving further and further apart.
Yeah.
So then that depiction of hell would be, is the opposite of what you're talking about, where instead of people moving further and further apart as they did in the Great Divorce and on the new earth in Jerusalem, people are coming closer and closer together.
Yes.
And, you know, just by sharing what they have, like as far as culture is concerned, is that
yes. I think so. And by that, I don't mean that Lewis was thinking all that in the Great Divorce, but like that, yes. I think there's great truth in that. Now let me go on to Revelation 22 now. Then And so this is, you know, just after the nations of the earth, kings of the nations of the earth and all that. Revelation 22, verse 1. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Down, so Christ is the Lamb. Interesting, the throne of God and the Lamb. Some say, okay, it's two different thrones, and one's God the Father, one is the one's the, you know, Christ the Son, but or some visualize it more predominantly as the one throne being Christ, the eternally incarnate Son of God. But anyway, it's from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. So here you have a river flowing through. Have we got? Yeah, this goes till 5, is that right? Okay. Okay, I just want to make sure we are not totally distracted. Okay. All right, so you've got the river coming down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. Okay, so now you have the tree of life. Well, when did we last see the tree of life on the earth? In Genesis. Now, there are some allusions, figurative allusions, I think, primarily to Proverbs, suits like a tree of life or something. Then in early in Revelation chapter 2 or 3, it talks about the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. And it's like the tree of life has apparently been held in the present heaven, awaiting its replanting on the new earth. It's a fascinating thing. It's like that didn't cease to exist. God, it still existed. And it was like the symbol of, no, it will not, Satan will not win the victory. I will replant this tree of life. But now, the tree of life is on both sides of the river, and it's bearing a new fruit every month. The tree of life is like a forest of life. It's like it's way bigger. Well, the tree of life, there were two people in that garden. Well, now we have a multitude of people on the new earth. And it seems appropriate, you know, that the tree of life has taken on these new dimensions, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And it's very obvious, without the words being stated, that this fruit will be eaten. Okay? This is not the forbidden tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This is the tree of life. You know, and so freely being able to eat of it, and it's the life-giving tree, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. And some speculate that that's just kind of figuratively saying, okay, the nations will be forever healed. But others say that, well, it might be possible, even in a resurrection body, to dislocate a shoulder or something. You know, is that possible? Could Adam and Eve, in a perfect world, could they have sprained an ankle? Well, I think that's likely. Well, in a resurrection body, will we be utterly impervious to everything? And I think you can make a case for saying, yeah, we'll be utterly impervious to it. Or you can make a case for saying, if anything ever goes wrong, it can be immediately healed.
It's not the same thing, huh?
See, what's that?
It's kind of the same thing. If you're hurt, but then immediately healed, it's almost like there's no problem. Yeah, you know.
It's like there's problems, but they don't
last very long. Yes, it would be not suffering. There could be pain, but suffering is an ongoing condition. So there would be no suffering in such a world, but there might be an immediate need for help. And again, these are different views of the eternal state, but trying to make sense of the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Of course, the medicinal properties of leaves and herbs and, you know, different things like that. Some argue in that direction. Okay, but here is the great statement in verse 3, no longer will there be any curse. Now, by the way, that statement makes no sense. You would never say of the present heaven in the dwelling place of God, no longer will there be any curse. You would say this of a true earth. You see? Now, some people say, oh, this is all just figures of speech of a disembodied state. And you go, what? I mean, we're told Jesus has a physical resurrection body. And no longer will there be any curse. Well, what was there a curse on? The earth. And it was the result of sin. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. Now, some translations say his servants will worship him. The word can be translated every way, either way, but I like that idea of it's the worship, but worship through service. That's what servants are doing. They serve him. And so some people, when they talk about nothing to do on a new earth, servants will serve him. Servants are always given things to do by their masters, and the most responsible servants come up with their own things to do. They know what needs to be done.
And didn't God make us to work and not be idle? I mean, isn't like...
Exactly. It's a return to the original intention God had for the world. Now, it's way better. I'm not... Don't think that I'm saying the new earth is simply a return to Eden. It's a return to Eden and much more. But we have within us this nostalgia for Eden. And there's something Lewis said. He didn't call it a nostalgia for Eden, but he used the word nostalgia. Whether that was in The Weight of Glory or what it was in, I don't recall. But he's referring to this built, and I think it might have been Mere Christianity, but this thing that is in us that harkens back to the way it once was. And you think about this. We are connected to Adam and Eve. We all sinned in Adam. Well, if we are so connected to our forebears, you know, if we're so connected to Adam that we could have sinned in him, could there be built into us in our DNA, could there be like a genetic sense or consciousness of Eden? I think so. I mean, look at the thirst for utopia. What are we looking? Now, there's a lot of wrong ways that people have come up with to get to utopia. They're all wrong, short of the intervention of Christ, you know, himself.
Fountain of youth.
Yeah, fountain of youth. There's this sense. I mean, if you accounted for this world purely by naturalism, purely by philosophical materialism, I don't think it's sufficient to explain the yearnings, the hearkening back toward. Why wouldn't the highest form of animals simply be content to be the highest form of animals? What is it in us that yearns not just for something we've never had, though that, true, but yearns backwards for something we once had? There's that sense. It goes both ways. See, we are people who live on a fallen earth, who live with a nostalgia for Eden and a longing for the new earth. We're between the two. Now, what are the practical implications of that for how you live your life as a Christian? Well, they're tremendous. Because if you know your past and you know your future, you are able to make choices in the present that are in light of who you really are and what you really want and what God has actually called you to and how you're going to live for eternity. And it also makes sacrifice much more acceptable because it's temporary. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that will be revealed in us. We have friends who are missionaries who are now in their 70s, maybe, but in Russia, who years ago, somebody asked them the question, okay, now your children are grown, you're separated from them, maybe they're going to have children, and then maybe you'll be separated from your grandchildren when you go over there and you keep serving over there in Russia. Have you thought about that? And you know, their response was, you know, well, we have, and we love our kids, and we're going to see them, and they're going to come over to see us and all that. But you know what? People need to be reached with the gospel. And then they made the statement, our children are following Jesus. We will have all eternity to spend with them in the presence of our God and with people. And I think that's a true perspective. Yeah, they're making a short-term sacrifice. But there's a long-term benefit. So let me go further and make sure we wrap this up. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face. Wow. I mean, that statement, they will see his face. That's what used to be called the beatific vision. And the word beatific, it's a Latin word that means happy-making. That's the happy-making sight. The beatific vision, the happy-making sight, is God himself. Now, if you are not in right relationship with God when you see him, it is not a happy-making sight. You are overwhelmed with your sin as opposed to his holiness. And you dread. It's a fearsome thing. It's a terrible thing to fall in the hands of the living God. But if you are clothed the very righteousness of Christ, he is your father, you are his child, and you are seeing God, and you don't have to turn away. And yeah, you, I'm sure, will kneel in his presence and then can envision Christ lifting us up to our feet and embracing us, and we shall see God. That's the name of my latest book where I took from the sermons of Charles Spurgeon. Many of the greatest things that have ever been said about heaven were said in the sermons of Charles Spurgeon, but they come in 63 volumes. There's a paragraph break about every other page, and very few people are ever going to. But if you've read Morning and Evening and some of Spurgeon's other things, you know how great Spurgeon is, but most people never get into his sermons, so I got to put that together. But we shall see God. One of his masters about, what will it mean to see God? They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light. And here it is, they will reign forever and ever. Notice, it does not say, and he will reign forever and ever. Well, he will, of course. But that's not the point. They, the servants of God, the people of God, will reign forever and over. Reign over what? The earth. Go back to Genesis 1 and 2. What was our job from the beginning? To reign over the earth. To have dominion. So Christ came into the world not to deliver us out of a physical material existence on planet Earth, but to redeem this world, to redeem not just souls, but the world itself, the physical earth, the animals, the vegetation, the realm, to make it into a new earth, which we, his righteous and eternally righteous children, will reign over forever. And think of New Jerusalem as capital city of new earth, capital planet of a new universe, new heavens and earth. And when you think in those terms, then you can get excited about heaven, you can get excited about redeemed culture, and it gives you all the more reason to share your faith with an unbeliever. So often I think Satan has done this number on us and deceived us about the nature of heaven. And so is it any surprise that a Christian wouldn't be all that motivated? Think about my pastor friend that I was talking about, who, by the way, has changed his mind radically on the subject of heaven. But, you know, what motive do you have to share your faith with an unbeliever so that they too can spend eternity in this dull, drab, incredibly boring place to which annihilation would be preferable? Now, that doesn't give you a lot of motivation to share your faith. Does that make sense? We got, what, 6 minutes left? Any final questions, comments? Yes?
I wanted to ask you about how you see time when you talk about you know, the new earth. And
yes.
Because from my point of view, in the millennium, we have the 1,000 years. Of
yes.
Which is measurable, but don't you think that in the, like, in heaven, basically we won't be bound by time?
Well, I agree that we will not be bound by time. I do believe, however, and I think Scripture is pretty clear on this, that we will experience time. Time and space, I think, if you actually look at it, are the nature of the environment for finite beings. Time and space are not the product of our being fallen, but they are the product of our being finite. And I think there's nothing bad about time and space and the restriction to time and space for a finite creature. Now, time, as we know it, can work against us, where the clock is ticking and I can't accomplish this, or I'm getting closer to the day of my death, or boredom, time going on with nothing to do, all of that. But I believe that is time under the curse. Now, why do I believe that there's time in heaven? Glad you asked. Revelation 8:1, when he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for half an hour. Wow. There was silence in heaven for half an hour. So that's the present. That's the present heaven. Okay, well, what about the new earth? Will there be time on the new earth? If there wasn't going to be time anywhere, you'd think it would be in the probably in the present heaven. But on the new earth, is there anything we talked about before that Scripture said that would give you a hint about time on the new earth?
The thing about day and night, the trees bearing the fruit
every month. Month is a measurement of time. So I think that that is an area where I've corresponded with lots of people in this, because I get a lot of people saying, yeah, but I don't think there's going to be time. I think there will be time, and we need to understand that God exists outside of time. And what people often think, they say, yeah, but with the Lord, a day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. Right. The operative statement being with the Lord, because he is not subject to time, though he chose to enter time in the person of Christ. And he entered space and time, and Christ will reign on the throne of the new Jerusalem, the God-man, for all eternity. And so I think there will actually be time. Now, of course, some people disagree with that. But I've got a chapter in my big book on heaven on the subject of time.